Hi, welcome back to Food Radio. We're joined by a special guest and good friend of mine named Karen Wong.
Hi, Dong.
Hi. And so I've known Karen for a bunch of years now. Actually, probably one of the... Actually, there's a lot of firsts with you, I think, in terms of my own career, I realized. But we'll get into kind of what the kind of details, especially what Karen does. But I think just exciting because, amongst other things, Karen was... if not the first, really the linchpin of the person that introduced me to a lot of the people that I know now in Chinatown, and they're doing work in and around Chinatown. I think you were the one that invited me down to the Apex Gala back in the day. So a huge reason I wanted you on this program was simply, this program wouldn't exist had you not introduced me to a lot of that world.
Wow, that's special, Dong. That's a lot of pressure.
A lot of pressure on you to make sure it's good. For better or for worse, this program would not have existed. But I think it was because of that that I think my interest in Chinatown started growing. My interest in just being Chinese, frankly, started growing. Mm. Or coming back anyway. And I realized that as we were setting this up, that it was really kickstarted a lot by you just simply saying, hey, meet these people. And you still do that, which is amazing. So thank you.
You're welcome.
So Karen is the deputy director at the New Museum. And what I'd like to do, actually, Karen, is just sort of work backwards in terms of what you do and get to the point where you really started the path to getting to where you are now.
Okay.
But could you just explain kind of maybe even just this week, what did you do this week? Oh. What does your job entail?
Well, you know, I'm really lucky, and usually the soundbite that I use is that I am a cheerleader for culture. One of the things that I'm so privileged as well as lucky, I'm passionate about culture, advocating for it, knowing that it has impact in the world, in our community, with my friends, with myself. And at the New Museum, I've been allowed to really explore that, particularly through a couple of initiatives, which, again, you've been very much a part of. One of them is Idea City, which is our platform for civic engagement, to make sure people realize artists need to be at the table when we're reimagining cities. And when I mean artists, that's a big group of people, cultural practitioners, architects, poets, filmmakers, graphic designers. And then 5 years ago, we started the New Inc. Incubator. So that's the first museum-led incubator where we have workspace and professional development for folks who are working at the intersection of art, design, and tech. And oftentimes people are asking, well, why is a museum doing that? And certainly 5 years ago, people thought we were crazy, and now we've got museums and cities flocking to us trying to figure out what's the blueprint. Mm. But essentially, as a museum space, we've always been wanting to experiment, to innovate, and we certainly believe in what the next generation is doing, and we want to be a part of that, and we want to figure out how to make their practices, their business, their projects sustainable, and also figure out where should it be shown, where should they be in this world.
And how long have you been at the New Museum now?
Oh, gosh. A dozen years.
Okay.
So... that's like six more years than I had ever anticipated. But I think that has a lot to do with this idea where I've always tried to kind of live my life in chapters. Mm. Or, I mean, the thing that I'm quite envious about the millennial generation is that they're the slash, right? They're a DJ slash writer slash coder slash stylist slash activist. And I think certainly my generation, Gen X, we've always seen our professional careers as more of a journey.
Okay.
So I think I'm a quasi-slash person. It's just I've done each component individually. So like I've amassed a lot of different kind of careers over, the last 25.
But it does seem like when you first started at New Museum, because what you were just explaining before was, I mean, even the definition of what a museum is, what the museum is expected to get into or start, or the programming or ideas that people expect a museum to do, you guys have really expanded, obviously, what a typical museum is. And part of that is Well, I guess the question was, when you first started there, was that the goal? When you jumped over and said, I'm going to kind of be part of a new museum now, was it to actually continue to expand, add those slashes to what a museum is?
I think, you know, Lisa Phillips, our director, there's only been two directors in our 40-year history, both of them women. And I think certainly for her, she's always had an entrepreneurial spirit. So I think it was within our wheelhouse that we would continue iterating on what a museum could be in the 21st century. And certainly I think the energy kind of grew and grew as we understood what our place was on the Bowery. Our mission is new art, new ideas. So it's a pretty intentional yet expansive missions, which allows us to operate the way we've done so far.
Do you feel like at the moment there's anything you couldn't get yourself into through the new museum in terms, like, because you've set up that the flexibility and the freedom, it seems like, to explore a lot of different things. Is there a limit at the moment? Does it feel like there's a limit?
Doesn't feel like there's a limit. I'm still there. I mean, a couple of other things that I've really wanted to do is teach, and so and I've been given the latitude to do that. So I teach a graduate seminar up at Columbia, which I believe you know that school very well.
I know that school very well.
And of course,
unfortunately, you weren't there teaching when I was there.
And then, you know, we have a second building. So our main building, designed by Sana, amazing architect, something you and I share, a love of architecture. And we have, we bought a second building back in 2008, thinking in 10 years we'd be ready to expand. So we're at that point.
You guys planned really well.
Yeah. So we had a competition about a year ago, and we've chosen OMA, Rem Koolhaas, Shohei Shigemutsu. And, so we'll reveal what that looks like early next year.
I was going to say, I know the architecture community especially is dying to see stuff.
I know. Yes.
What can you share with us at Food
we're
Radio?
We're dying to show it. And so, you know, we'll be ready early next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
I won't pry too
much. Don't pry.
I'll wait.
I'm under NDA. Don't pry.
And one of the reasons I wanted to ask about the kind of freedom side is you as a person, I guess, and what you're able to do, let's say even just sticking to through the new museum at the moment, does seem in so many ways like, I can picture people being, oh, shit, I want that job. I want to be able to do some version of what you carved out or created or made happen in the new museum. So I was wondering if you could talk about kind of what the mundane day-to-day, like, what does that job actually look like?
What does it look like?
Because it sounds amazing, but also it's probably just a lot of meetings and emailing.
It is. My portfolio is fairly expansive. I oversee all forward-facing or public-facing communications and marketing. So that was originally my first job at the new museum, was director of external affairs, and to build that up. So obviously, you know, that remains a really fun and exciting part of my job that I know very well at this point, you know, how you advocate and how you create campaigns around your exhibitions, around your projects, around your initiatives. And in some ways, the work has been not easy, but when you have, like, one of the best curators in the world, Massimiliano Gianni, at the museum, creating programming that is, you know, some folks, these are not my words, but some folks say it's unrivaled, then, you know, obviously that makes your job pretty fun. Of course, I mean, you know, when you are developing initiatives, there's a lot of partnership work. I think that's one of the things we do really well is collaboration and in partnership work, which I love. You know, there's a lot of negotiating, there's some compromising. There are a lot of meetings. There's a lot of emails, but you know, I've been very lucky. A lot of the work I do is about manifesting. So it's about producing something. It's about creating platforms where I get to meet people like you and, you know, in the amazing projects you've led. So I don't know. I can't really give you a downside right now. I mean, I'm trying to think.
That's good.
I mean, my office is really messy and I wish I, you know, yeah.
That's
I wish I was more organized, but.
That's a livable downside, yeah. I think. So, okay. So let's, you have this dream job in so many ways. And especially I think what you're in terms of the material you have to work with from the curator to the institutional support to other people you meet and are able to meet. And so basically the question is like, how did you get here? Did you have museum experience before joining the museum?
I did not. Not at all. I think perhaps that was a strength for me in terms of I looked at things with an outsider point of view. Mm. And again, I have to sing my boss's praises for, you know, recognizing that. And again, that kind of goes back to her ability to look at things from a different angle. Mm. I mean, the way that I actually came to the museum segues pretty nicely in terms of what I used to do. And I was the managing director for David Adjaye, an architect in London who has gone on to do amazing work and, you know, probably the first black architect to break a glass ceiling within that field, that discipline. We were one of the five teams shortlisted in 2002 to design the new museum. Mm. So we were so excited. We thought for sure we were going to win the competition. we were very, very confident. so anyways, as you know, architectural competitions are really hard, and we did not win.
Did you know who you were up against at that point?
We did not.
Okay.
We had an inkling, and certainly I think we did know that Sana was involved, and there's somebody whom both of us had long admired. So to even be in the same competition with them at that time, back in 2002, was a real honor. Mm. And so we lost, but several years later, I bumped into Lisa, and she asked if you might want to come back to New York.
Interesting.
Yep. And
did she know you were? Were you considering that before she asked?
I was not at all. Huh. I was, you know, in London. We were in year six of building David's office, which had, you know, when I had started in 2000, we were about 6-7 people. Mm. By the time I left in 2006, we were 30. So that was a pretty great run with some amazing cultural and social projects.
And so, I mean, you said you were invited to the new museum competition in 2002.
Yep.
The office was 2 years old when you were?
Yes, yes.
That's incredible.
Yes. Well, he had a partner beforehand.
Okay.
And around 1999, 2000, several of close friends, including myself, were encouraging him. It'd be amazing if it were just his name on the door.
Got it.
So,
cool.
Yeah. So yes, so around 2006, early 2006, Lisa Phillips approached me and said, you know, this museum is being built now, and by Sana, and I was very lucky that that was just kind of the right moment for someone to broach me about making a move. I think. I mean, maybe subconsciously, I had been putting that energy out into the world. I had very much wanted to come back to New York. I wanted to come back to the East Coast, primarily to be closer to my parents.
Okay.
So it happened at just the right time. So I came back, in the summer of 2006 to New York.
Do you remember, you said you ran into Lisa. Do you remember where that was?
I do. It was at the Miami Art Fair.
Okay.
At the Basel, Miami. I think it was year one or year two of that fair. And she bumped in, we bumped into each other, and she said, oh, you know, next time you're in New York, let's have a drink. Uh-huh. And so several months later, I followed up.
Right. Because I feel like it's always those moments. I mean, that's obviously the, not the start of that big shift, because the start, I guess, was when you were doing the competition. But it seems like a seminal moment that could have been very casual, could have gone nowhere, but obviously went somewhere quite exciting. Did you have a sense at that time when you bumped into she said, let's have a drink, that this could lead to something really exciting, or it's just something I should do because it's the professional thing to do?
It was more the professional thing to do. I really, had not anticipated that would be the conversation when I came into town. You know, it's interesting because in my job, in any job I've had, I've been very strategic and very deliberate. But when it comes to an overarching plan for what my quote-unquote professional life has consisted, it's been more about kismet, which is, you know, hard to define and hard to relay, with the exception that I truly believe if you put your head down, you work really hard, you work for, at that moment, what's really important to you. When you're ready for the next leap, the right energy will come back to you. It's like karma.
Right. And I guess your ears and eyes will be sort of open to it more than if you hadn't
exactly.
put that out there.
I mean, certainly, probably not. This is not the blueprint I want everybody to follow, but for whatever reason, it's worked.
But
for
I will
me.
Actually, I think that's almost universally every guest. You know, the guests range in strategic versus coincidental, but for the most part, I don't think any guest had planned to be exactly where they are now. And some have taken very circuitous paths, some have very direct paths, but there's always moments where like, oh, I did not expect that to be a turning point, or I just did it because it felt right at the time. It wasn't, I didn't know where it would go. And that's actually very heartwarming for me to hear, very, very comforting to hear that it's very human, I think. Mm. You can only plan so much for A, but also I think at some point people end up trusting their intuition and kind of listening to themselves and be like, this is something I need to explore. I don't know what it's going to turn into. But that has actually, nobody has said, I did this. That's exactly what the plan was and I achieved it. That has not been, maybe it's an unrealistic model, at least in the kind of creative people that we talk to.
Well, I think you've hit it on the dot, which is creative people. I think it's much harder to determine what your pathway is in the creative fields, because we're not given the, you know, vertical ladder model where if you're in the finance world, you know, there's different rungs you have to reach to get to quote unquote success. I think we're lucky in a way that success is a much broader notion when you're talking about the arts. So
I was talking, was it with John yesterday, an artist named John Wang, and
with
Felix from Pinup. We're here yesterday.
Love Felix.
They're both incredible. I'd never met John before, but and I started having this realization, I think also with the previous guests, that creative field, and certainly I think non-straight white males, let's say basically anybody that had something different about them, there was a correlation with a lot more acceptance and success, and I feel like a part of it is that there's always a need for progression and difference and newness and kind of innovation and creativity basically in the creative field. So you're always looking for something else.
Yeah.
It's never that succeeded 100 times before, we're going to keep doing that. And that I think applies even to the kind of how, what person looks like or how they present themselves. But part of it was I didn't really think about that before I started this radio show, but it was nice to be able to tease that out of a lot of people. Okay, so Ajay's office, did you have...
In London.
In London. So actually, as an aside, that's where I met you. The first time was I applied for a job at Ajay's office, and you interviewed me.
I have to be honest, I don't remember.
No, I don't expect you to. I'm sure
I didn't remember it specifically until you brought it up to me years ago.
I don't think it was. I can't imagine it was a particularly remarkable, like, I don't think I was particularly remarkable as an interviewee, so I don't expect you to remember it at all. And I remember being very excited to see The Office. I frankly did not know much about The Office.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I actually applied is because I applied to an office that you guys shared a building with, whose name I forget at the moment, but I think it was a two-person office. How I found them, I don't even know. And they said, oh, we don't hire right now because we're only two people, but
right.
you should apply to this office behind us named David Ajay's, right? Ajay's office. And so I did. And you offered a job, actually. And the reason I didn't take it was because another small office, also in the same building, offered me £50 more a week.
Well, I'm glad I offered you a job.
You did offer me a job.
Because it's like,
no, anyways, I was very, I think you were, those are the two job offers I got in
right,
London.
Right. But one was 50 pounds
more. One was 50 pounds more a week.
Oh
and
my gosh.
At that point, that was. That
you probably
was,
chose wrong, but it's not always about wrong. The money. It's not always about the money, dude. Woo!
And yeah. I was like, I'll take it. I mean, I think when the salary in total was £400 a week.
Mm.
That 50 made a big difference.
I know. I apologize.
No, don't at all. I totally enjoyed this. The office called M3, by the way. Yeah. But it was great. But it was funny that I don't think I realized that you were you when I met you again in New York until a little while later. Obviously, at that point, you were sort of Karen Wong from the New Museum.
Right.
And I think you must have mentioned that you were at Ajay's for a while and I pieced it together.
Right.
But I do remember being excited on that interview that it was interviewed by a Chinese person, because that was obviously not something I expected. Anyway, so when you were getting into Ajay's office, did you have experience architecturally in terms of, or from architecture or from running a kind of architectural business in any way?
No, not at all. Mm. So this is becoming a running theme, as you can see, lack of experience. No, I think, or quote unquote, I have experience that's transferable.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what had happened was I had wrapped up my time at a graphic design office in Boston, which I had founded. And I had, in some ways, rewarded myself to go to London. I was also at that point a very young divorcee. Mm. So I thought, ooh, new canvas, mm-hmm. new city, great energy. So I went to London initially for what I thought would be maybe 6 or 7 months just to chill out. I called it, you know, a sabbatical.
Right.
Or that's what I told my parents. It's a sabbatical. And David Ajay had been close friends with my sister. They all met at the Royal College of Art.
Oh, interesting.
It was a really special time in terms of the type of talent and terrific personalities that were coming out of that school, which included Chris O'Feely and the Chapman brothers, Tim Noble and Sue Webster. Mm. So just super exciting atmosphere. And David had, my sister said, oh, you and David are going to be great friends. So we were friends. And then subsequently, you know, around 99, 2000, he said, okay, I'm ready to open up my own shop. And I said, cool. I was like, I'm in London. I got nothing to do. I'll hang out and volunteer for 6 months. Let's see what happens. And I guess I was at that point really naive because having come from graphic design where you can do projects in 2 or 3 mm. weeks, I hadn't understood the cycle for architectural projects, which is really, you know, 2 to 10 years. So anyways, I ended up committing myself to spending a chapter there. So I was there for 6 years, and which was quite frankly like a cycle of work, mm. a cycle of projects. And it was an incredible time. I certainly know how to read plans in sections.
Okay.
But I think, you know, what I brought to the table again was more of a kind of a strategic angle in terms of how you tell the narrative, how you shape an office. I was also looking after, potentially new business. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things which did garner us a lot of attention, of course, it's the work first, but I think people were very curious that David, a Guinean man, had, next to him, his managing directors, the lieutenant was an Asian American woman. Mm-hmm. So, and even back then in London, as open, in quotes, as it was, certainly a black man and an Asian woman, I think, caused a little bit of a stir, mm-hmm. and a lot of people were curious about the office. Mm-hmm. But, it was also a really exciting moment that two people of color were making waves very quickly in an architectural community that has been historically very privileged and mm-hmm. very white.
And you were, at the beginning of that partnership or relationship, you were very aware that the two of you standing next to each other was a very different looking
yes.
pair than you would typically see.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you guys, I don't know how to ask this. How did you guys take advantage of that?
Mm.
I mean, mechanically, like what are the things you did? Cause I also feel like I'm sure you were very careful with balancing it well
right.
and not overplaying that card, but also being very clear and upfront about it.
I think the way we took advantage of that was just showing up,
being there.
Yeah. Just showing up, being at a lot of industry events, and also, very deliberate because I saw David and he is very much, not only a leader in the architectural community, but an important leader in the educational sphere. And so I wanted to make sure that he was guest lecturing mm-hmm. a lot at both universities in Europe as well as in the United States. So I think, for lack of a better word, just being very present.
Mm-hmm. Was there, because now certainly I think he's just generally one of the leaders, I think, in the architecture profession in general, yeah. but also still very much looked to, I think, as an architect of color, which is still relatively rare. Certainly, it's not as prevalent as your classic sort of white male architect. Was there a moment, certainly when you guys started, was it still looked at as a kind of novelty, or was there a moment where it switched from a curiosity that there are these two people of color running this firm into something that was an asset in some way? I don't know if you can answer that. But
I think that's hard to answer. I think when you come from a marginalized community and you band together, I think it's always an asset mm-hmm. With regards to showing up for your community, being a model, if possible.
Maybe even from a business point of view, I can imagine that there's challenges to that, being a minority and
I think so.
Way.
I think certainly I felt trying to operate in the London milieu was difficult, number one, because I was a woman, number two, because I was an Asian, and number three, I was American. So there were but on the other hand, I think some of the times the reason why we got meetings was because we were also, two people of color. Mm-hmm. And then certainly once you get through the door and you show yourselves to be both skillful and talented, then that's then the second conversation is much easier.
Right.
Yeah.
So the graphic design office in Boston, you said?
Yes.
You founded it and what was it called?
It was called Habermock Design.
Okay.
Habermock is a snake, a Native American snake god of visions and dreams.
Oh, sweet.
And actually, I have to, I guess, cred my ex-husband for coming up with that name.
Okay.
But yes, I started a small graphic design firm specifically for nonprofits and social causes. Mm. And my sister-in-law at the time, who was also a graphic designer, joined me. And we operated a terrific office for, I guess, again, it was about 6-7 years. Small, important detail about Boston has the most nonprofits per square mile than any other city.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
there were a lot of clients, or at least there was a well, you know. And no, it was really an exciting time, and I think running my own business in my 20s really was the foundation in terms of having a certain level of confidence of how to pursue anything, mm-hmm. how to project manage, how to manage people, also how to look after money.
Mm-hmm.
So we achieved all of those things. And, you know, we were about 6 or 7 people by the time I had left, and I sold my portion of the company to her so that I could go to London.
Mm-hmm. Were you designing in the office?
I was, yes. So I'm not by training a graphic designer, but certainly when I was at Brown, I double majored in both art practice and art history. And so designing came pretty easy to me. I'm not a great designer. I'm a good designer. I think I'm a much better editor. So in terms of aesthetics, I do know when something is absolutely right.
Was there a moment when you left the graphic design company to move to London where you consciously made a switch away from being an active designer and more almost a curator of designers and director type and producer type? Like, did you, do you remember that moment where you're like, well, I'm not really going to pick up a pencil, you know, theoretically anymore?
You know, I think that switch was more gradual. It, I can't really say that I remember, oh, I'm going to switch from this or that. It's just there was a different kind of opportunity, different kind of challenge, which was to help build an office. But during that time, I still ended up picking up a number of graphic design projects just to keep my...
While you were in London.
Yeah, my faculties operating. and many of them were just obviously internal in terms of David's office. We were very lucky to publish a couple of books pretty quickly, which I oversaw.
Oh, great.
And I was also... had struck up a friendship with Chris O'Feely. So I designed a number of his artist books back in the day, which you can, you know, try to find on eBay for a lot of money. Kidding.
Well, it's funny, is I think I came across Ajay and Ophelia at the same time.
Mm.
I feel like there was a gallery that David designed for one of, like, an exhibition of Chris's
yes.
work.
Yes.
I just remember there was, like, a weird, like, long, tunnely entrance.
You're right, yes. Right? That was at Victoria Muro. And Chris had an amazing exhibition, which premiered 12 paintings, 12 or 13 paintings of monkeys who were also kings. Mm. And David designed... a stunning kind of vessel for those paintings, which included a long hallway, which, you know, when we talk about this idea of how everyone is so enamored with immersive spaces now, but I mean, I think people have been creating immersive experiences for many decades. We just used different names back then. But yes, there was this long hallway and a particular type of wood where the smell and the darkness really set yourself up. So when you turned the corner and you saw these 12 paintings, which were theatrically lit.
And they were large, right?
They were large, yeah. You know, that was a big wow moment for the art world to understand, you know, you don't have to hang paintings on white walls. Yeah. And I think certainly Chris and David really enlarged the vocabulary of what exhibition making could look like. And certainly both of them, both together and individually, continue to do that.
Mm. Well, I mean, I just thinking now that I think whenever I think of Chris Ofili's work, I realize I can't disassociate it with that space. Mm. I mean, it's not that I can't picture it outside of the space, of course, but there's something about the lighting that was there, the darkness of the room and the drama of the space. And there was, because of that, there was a richness to the environment that the pieces were hung in that for me just naturally then imparts itself on the work itself. everything about the work really has like a background of that tone that that David's space, I guess, created.
Well, it was interesting because the entire piece, meaning both the paintings as well as the architecture, the vessel, was bought by the Tate. Mm. So it's in their collection.
That's awesome.
And when you present it, you have to present the whole thing.
Huh. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. That makes me so happy. Okay, so you mentioned Brown.
Yes. Alma mater.
Okay. Did you go from finishing Brown, did you go straight from there to Boston? How did you end up in Boston, actually?
You know, Boston is like a default city for a lot of Brown grads. Mm. I guess, to be honest, I was a little intimidated coming to New York City. My sister was going to school in Cambridge, so I thought, ooh, this feels good. I'll move up to Boston, kind of a big city, and I'll have family near me. So, yeah, that was nice.
And what did you study at Brown?
Visual arts and art history. So double major.
Okay.
With a bit of semiotics. quite typical of Brown.
Did you know, I guess it's impossible to know, but before Brown even, were you already interested in art world, art history world? Or when did that kind of become apparent that that was something that you could see?
I mean, when I was in high school, I always thought I would be an artist. Mm. And I think when I got to college and I was in, you know, studio art classes, and I compared myself to other people in the room, I knew very quickly I didn't have the chops to be an artist per se. I think the best artists have a lot to say. And for whatever reason, I don't necessarily have that kind of pointed direction in terms of something to impart. And through college, I learned that my skill set was really to create a stage and to amplify what somebody wants to say.
You
so that's how come I think I moved very quickly from the idea of being an artist to being a designer. Huh. You know, and again, let's use everything kind of in air quotes.
But you already felt that while you were in college, that.
I had the revelation. Huh. I had the revelation that I just didn't have what it took.
Was it
to
actually
be an
a
artist.
Moment, or was it kind of like over time? You're like,
I think it was over like a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you?
Because even when I was a kid, you know, I would practice my signature, like, ooh, I hope this is a really cool signature for an artist.
Right.
So I had always had this dream. But I think I got lucky that I just figured it out early on that maybe this wasn't the right area.
Did you start putting that into practice in any way while you were still at school?
Yes, I actually started doing a lot of posters and t-shirts for other
<That's awesome.
laughs> like student groups and, you know, things like for the Women's Center or, you know, we had this thing called Funk Night. So, you know, I did a lot of t-shirts for Funk Night.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So.
Can you still find those t-shirts?
A lot of my friends actually have kept them and actually a couple of them recently I was on exchange with some of my friends, and some of them had actually framed them and like had them in their study or living room. And I was like,
I mean,
oh,
t-shirts are an art commodity now. I feel like you can bring back that slash of t-shirt design.
Yeah, I love designing t-shirts. Yeah,
it's worked for a number of people to launch entirely gigantic careers. So
I know.
For your next shift, maybe that's
right.
The way to do it.
That's right.
And so where did you grow up again?
You know, born in Queens.
Mm. Shout out to Queens.
Shout out to Queens. had a short stint in Stamford, Connecticut, which I remember very little of. Yeah. And of course, where I really grew up is North Carolina, Winston-Salem. Oh. My father got a job at R.J. Reynolds, the tobacco company. I hear everybody hissing in the background, but, you know, that was the job he could get, and it put me through college, so no more naysaying. Anyways, we grew up in Winston-Salem. I was in a high school, big high school. I think we had 500 in our class. There were two Asians it was me and a Korean girl.
Were you guys friends?
Not really. Huh. So... And I think early on, again, just this idea of negotiating kind of ethnic politics.
Yeah.
The school was half black, half white, and then a couple of Asian kids.
Huh.
So I would say it was kind of hard.
Did you, so just for context, what ages were you in Winston-Salem?
I think 8 to 18.
Okay.
Yeah.
So really those formative years.
Yeah.
In that high school, who did you hang out with between the white kids, black kids, and the other Asian girl?
I would say at that point, the majority of my best girlfriends were Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting that... I've always had a love for basketball, so I was the statistician on the basketball team, and I think, awesome. I think, you know, I guess if I were to come clean, you know, I had two big crushes when I was in high school, and both of them were on the basketball team. One was white, one was black. They will remain nameless. Anyways, So
did you ever fulfill your dream to date a basketball player?
I haven't. And it's still
time.
I'm still ready. I mean, you know, someone asked me the other day,
we'll open the hotlines up.
What would be your kind of dream boyfriend right now? And I was thinking, oh my God, some guy who has courtside tickets to the Knicks games. I was like, that would be really great. Anyways, because, you know, I'm way too old to be dating a basketball player, but I will date somebody who has courtside seats. No, anyways. But you know, growing up in ACC territory, basketball was a big deal.
Right.
You know, I grew up watching Michael Jordan, who at that time was at Chapel Hill, you know, and so, you know, UNC, Wake Forest games, Duke games. Yeah, it was definitely a part of my teenage years.
I mean, I can imagine growing up there weren't a lot of, let alone people that were like you, looked like you. Do you remember having anybody that you looked up to that was Asian, let's say, that you thought was doing something incredible, whether you knew them or not?
No, not at all.
Hmm.
I mean, it was pretty barren, and... I think when you grow up, you just assimilate very quickly and you just put up your defenses and you just, at that point, like many suburban Asian kids, you're just thinking, you have a one-track mind, mm-hmm. which is about, you know, where I'm going to college. Mm-hmm. And then in college, it's kind of a big, bright new world where all of a sudden you understand that you're Asian American. Then you understand you're Chinese American.
Right.
Then you understand you're Chinese American female. And then you're trying to figure out, oh, you know, am I heterosexual? Am I gay? Right. You know, so I think, you know, at college, it's an amazing time where all of a sudden all of these new identities are at your... You know, they're in your framework,
right.
which you never even thought of those things in high school. But then I felt like, because I married very young and a Caucasian guy, I somehow didn't get back to my Chinese-ness until I came back to New York 12 years ago. Mm. So it's interesting when you talk mm-hmm. about how I've introduced you to Chinatown, mm. you've thought about your Chinese-ness, and I have to say, coming back to New York as a very mature adult, that was kind of the big question for me. And I think particularly over the last 6 or 7 years since I've joined the Apex for Youth Board, I know you've had a couple of those guys on your show. I've been much more deliberate and intentional about the circle of friends that I'm trying to engage in, and so it's been really nice. I mean, I have a really strong group of Asian and African American girlfriends, and it's been, I guess, as I said, this moment in my life where I really want to explore this aspect. Mm-hmm. Which, certainly kind of feel in my 20s and 30s I didn't really get to.
Do you still have any family or connection to
North Carolina? Not so much. I mean, my mom and dad did stay there for a bit, but they've moved up to D.C. so that they want to be near a international airport, so their two daughters had no excuse not to visit them a certain number of times a year. But, on the other hand, I have a lot of fondness for my childhood. I grew up really slow. And certainly, the way my mom and dad brought us up, they exposed us to a lot of things which, typically I think Asian kids, or stereotypically Asian kids, are not exposed to. So I was doing dance and theater and art classes, and then we'd go into sports summer camps, and, then there was tennis and piano. So I had a really kind of enriching childhood that my parents provided.
The fact that I think you're, in your different chapters, like you mentioned, of going from place to place, and that there is that theme of jumping into something without obviously the kind of checked off expertise. There's transferable skills, let's say, but there isn't, I've did this before, I can do this again in a really refreshing and nice way. And obviously there seems to be a kind of, maybe bravery is the right word, but a way to like, I can do that. I can figure that out, even though it's not something I've done before. Was that outlook on tackling things and being interested in different things, was that something that you remember having when you were down in North Carolina?
Definitely. I think I was really lucky. Our parents just really encouraged us to seek things that we were going to enjoy kind of intellectually. Hmm. Maybe it was kind of this reverse psychology. Of course, we were expected to get good grades, but it was always most like... the thing that will make us most proud is if you try your hardest. And so I think it was that cocooned my sister and I to, I think, be a little bit more free in terms of where we actually would end up studying in college or where what we might do professionally. We kind of joke around. To spend this much money on their education and for both of us to end up in nonprofits. My sister's at the Education Commission, where she's trying to eradicate the idea of that's actually the wrong word. what her commission is trying to do is by 2030 make sure every child has the opportunity to receive an education. And that's, you know, that's globally.
That's amazing.
So that's, yeah, that's a Gordon Brown initiative.
Where is she
attached to
based?
World Bank.
Where is that based?
I guess it's technically based in D.C.
Okay, that's where she lives.
That's where she lives, okay. Yeah. So, so yeah, so Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
I love
Southern food. I love shrimp and grits, just if we want to.
I'm surprised that's actually not why we started hanging out. It's because of that. Because my is just through Southern food.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know if we've ever gone out for any kind of like Southern
I don't
food,
think we I have. Like... I mean, I'm so obsessed now just going out the hot pot. But I really do love Southern food. I love okra.
I love okra.
I love anything fried. So that's a lot of Southern food. But I do remember you had one question, which I did want to tell you, because it's just so funny and weird, because you said, how did I earn my first dollar?
Yes.
And when I was growing up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, I mean...
Can you do this in a Southern accent?
Everybody was such a prep. Preppy, 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 preppy. Everything was, you know, green and pink. And the first way I made money was... You won't believe this, Dong Ping Wong, is that I actually I painted barrettes.
No way.
Yes, I painted barrettes with little pigs. No, I am so serious. I can't believe that question like just really stirred up a kind of memory I had buried deep. So yes, back then hand-painted barrettes were a really big deal, and you could sell them for $6 to $10 a pair.
Oh shit!
Yes, and you used enamel paints with little paintbrushes. So you know, yeah. So
who did
even
you
back
them?
Then, I was very entrepreneurial. I sold them to at the local tennis shop.
Did you convince the shop to carry them, or did you set up a little how did you?
No, yeah, no, they carried them. That's awesome. They were on consignment. I sold a lot of barrettes.
I can tell.
I sold a lot of barrettes.
I really wish I was there for that pitch.
I know.
It's like pro shop. I know you have the one thing you don't have.
I know the one thing you don't have. Yeah, so like little tennis balls, little piglets.
Amazing.
Yeah. Anyways, that's yeah. So I started doing that around.
So
I think,
have you not started 10 or t-shirts, 11. Barrettes?
T-shirt. Yeah. I mean, honestly, yeah. I mean, Dao Yi Chow, watch out. I'm coming after you. Right behind you, public school. No.
Just keep all your rivals closed. And just...
Amazing. I know he's not doing barrettes.
Maybe he should. Apparently, it does pretty well. All right. I don't know where my question went. I was completely thrown off by your Southern accent. So I think we can start.
Oh, okay. So the other thing that was deeply troubling when I was in, Winston-Salem. So that's a fun, positive story. So weirdly there was this 6 month period. And again, maybe I was 12 or 13, you know, back then, this is when we still had landlines. And we would get this call around dinner time, just right before dinner time. And, you know, and I would pick up, and they and the person on the other line would be, oh, hello. I'm looking. I think I have the Wong number.
Oh, God.
I can't even tell it that well. But and then they would just hang up on us. And I mean, it's funny now, but at the time it was just weirdly humiliating. I mean, we all have humiliating experiences when we're kids. And
I mean, do you know how many Asian families were there in
zero? So we know they were calling us, and it had
you
to be
like
somebody we knew, or you know, on the phone book, you know,
they just,
someone
found
thought,
one.
Yeah, that's, you know, let's Jesus. Try out this joke, the Wong number. I've got the Wong number. Anyways,
how often did that was that? How often
those I all them? I remember is that it just happened a lot, and it just kind of at the time it freaked me out, and then I do remember. Years later, when I was campaigning to be, I don't know, you know, like a officer in high school, right? I used a slogan. I said, you can't go wrong with Wong. So I'm sure that's where I got it, right? You know, you can't go wrong with Wong.
But you owned it at that point. Were you always aware that you were someone different? That you looked different?
I was special.
You were special? You were always aware that you were this special?
I was always aware I was other. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think... you know, I mean, of course, you know, there's always the name calling because Wong rhymes with ping pong and King Kong.
My whole name rhymes with that.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? So, like, there was always, like, King Kong and I don't know. Kids always were making fun of me that way. But I think when I really realized I was other was probably when I was 16, 17, 18, and you have this thing in high school called the prom. Mm. And particularly when you're in a southern city, I mean, the prom is it, man. Like, if you're not going to the prom, you are nobody. And so, you know, and at that point, I wasn't really allowed to date, but I do know if, should I have been asked to the prom, my parents would have let me go. And I remember junior year, and I was like, oh, my God, you know, I really, you know, I didn't get asked my junior year. Senior year, there were all these rumors that this junior basketball player was going to ask me, but it didn't transpire. So I ended up not going to either of my proms. And bizarrely, you know, decades later, I still have a chip on my shoulder about not going to my prom. But also knowing that, you know, at that age, you know, I was not desirable. Hmm. Or I was not, you know, and certainly at that time it was like I was not pretty enough to be asked to go to the prom, you know. It was, yeah, some deep crap like that circulates in your mind when you're,
I mean, I wonder if people were just confused with the Asian person at the school.
How do I even be attracted to that?
Like, sure. It's not a...
I think we can go with that. Yeah, no, I think there was a little bit of that. And again, you know, college was a revelation where in that scenario, you know, the first week of freshman orientation, I got the type of attention that certainly I had hoped for, you know, in my last several years of high school.
You could sense it right away. It's amazing.
Yeah, so that was so in many ways. Yeah, that, you know, that's, I guess, it was a major transition, being in the South to being up North.
Did you, was there, at Brown, did you still feel other?
No. Hmm. No. I mean, in many ways, it just felt like, at Brown, identity politics, and certainly, you know, in the late 1980s and 90s, on campuses, I felt like there was a group for everybody, to the point that it felt a little superficial. But upon reflection, it just meant that every community was viable. Mm-hmm. Every community had a voice, and at that point too, you know, every community was supported by the university. So yeah, no, I mean, to be honest, I don't really remember that much about school except that was a very positive time for me.
And just I guess to kind of wrap it up, but I was also like, in the same way that you said, when you came to New York, that was the first time you started really feeling again, reconnecting, or you said it more consciously, I guess, reconnecting to the Chinese side of yourself. Mm. Why do you think that is? I mean, because even for me, I was like, oh, why did it take me so long? I don't know why. I mean, I'm sure I can break down, but it's not something obviously you plan for. And so I went to Berkeley where there's plenty of Asian people.
Right.
So there's not like the opportunities weren't there.
Um, I think as we get older, you know, when we look at our mortality and we look about how we're going to define our lives, and because I don't have kids and was, it was never something I was that interested in, but certainly seeing amongst my friends everyone having a family, including my sister, and being very much a part of her boys, her two boys' lives, you know, I think a lot of these things stir up for us at this moment to think about what is family, what is extended family. And so I guess that's the reason, perhaps, maybe the idea of, you know, kind of getting back to my Chinese roots was important to me.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you did, so that then you could also introduce me to my Chinese roots.
I know. I mean, it's so funny that, like, I would be that person. But
you're totally that person. It's amazing.
But I'll take it, man. I'll take it.
Thanks. Well, thanks for it. I mean, it's funny that, you know, met you through Ajay's office, met you again through New Museum. Now you're a board member for Plus Pool, so meet you all the time through that.
Yeah.
And now meet you just by being a Wong and by being Chinese, basically. But you're the King Wong, so that's...
Well, Queen Wong.
Oh, Queen Wong, sorry.
No, thank you so much for doing this project.
Yeah,
I think it's really meaningful. You. And it's an honor to be one of your your subjects.
Awesome. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.